Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hello and welcome. This is the best in paranormal talk radio. You're listening to Beyond the Darkness. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, Tim Dennis. Well, we're wrapping up another week, going by quick here for us. Tomorrow night, we're going to be talking about vanquishing ghosts and demons. Sandrea Mossis will be our guest for the show. We also have a brand new Theater of the Mind, a very creepy story of a man trying to break his connection to the other world. That's tomorrow on the best in paranormal talk radio. And remember, on Saturday night, I'm going to be hosting Coast to Coast AM, where we're going to be discussing EVP, electronic voice phenomena, and kind of this really interesting version of paranormal investigating John Sable has developed, where he does it almost like an archaeological dig to get right to specific moments in time. And I think you're going to be blown away by some of the audio that you're able to hear on that episode. You can find more information about the show by checking out coasttocoastam.com/stations, and you'll find all of the stations in and around the United States and around the world to listen to the show. That'll be late night Saturday, early morning Sunday, midnight till 4 a.m. Central, so you can join me for that. And please do us a huge favor right now. We need your help. You can go to podcastone.com and click on the survey banner that you find on that site. You can help my podcast stay free to download and have very minimal ads by going there. The survey is very short. It's completely anonymous, and it takes no more than 5 minutes. That's all you have to do. Go to podcastone.com, click on the survey banner. And if you filled out a survey in the past, we thank you, but we still need you to do it again. You do all of us here at Beyond the Darkness and Podcast One and the Jericho Network a huge favor by filling out that survey. And it goes a long way to support our program. So please take the time to just go out and check out and complete that survey right now. All right, this evening we've got a guest, but it's been a long time since he's been with us on Darkness Radio. His first visit here in Beyond the Darkness, Dr. Andrew Nichols is a psychologist, parapsychologist, and investigator of alleged poltergeist cases and other paranormal phenomena. He's a member of the American Psychological Association, the Parapsychological Association, and the Society for Psychological Hypnosis. He's been a psychology professor for many years and is an adjunct faculty of parapsychology at Santa Fe College in Gainesville, Florida. And Dr. Nichols is listed in the Who's Who in American Teachers. In 2013, he was selected as one of Gainesville's 27 most interesting people by Insight Magazine. And the reason we love to have him on the show is because during his 30-year career, Dr. Nichols has investigated more than 600 reported cases of ghosts, hauntings, and poltergeist, and conducted studies in telepathy, precognition, and paranormal dream experiences. He's written numerous articles on paranormal experiences for popular magazines such as Fate, and his scientific papers on the paranormal have been published in scientific journals such as the Journal of Parapsychology, International Journal of Parapsychology, European Journal of Parapsychology, and Proceedings of the Parapsychological Association. He's here with us tonight on Beyond the Darkness. It's great to talk to you again, Dr. Andrew Nichols.
It's a pleasure to be here with you, Dave, and thank you for inviting me on this evening.
Well, it's great. You know, and tonight we're going to bring a little something different. When you brought this up as a topic, it really kind of lit me up with an intrigue, because this is something I didn't even consider chatting with you about. But discussing witchcraft and magic from a parapsychologist's perspective, that's a really kind of a fascinating aspect to this. As somebody who's investigated claims of ghosts and poltergeist activity, what made you start to look into the realm of witchcraft and magic?
Well, this is actually a topic that I've been interested in for many years. And in the last few years, I've been focusing on this area pretty exclusively, namely the correlations between certain ancient practices, particularly pagan religious practices, and what people regard as paranormal experiences, because the two are closely interrelated, but it's an area that's largely neglected by most psychologists and parapsychologists.
The idea that witchcraft exists and Wiccan practices and beliefs and the idea of magic, you know, I mean, it seems like that's something that should have gone away with the Dark Ages. The idea that we can create magic and we can alter perceptions, alter time, alter history, and create something out of nothing, that seems so archaic of an idea to me. But yet there is a huge following to that. There's a very strong belief system in magic and witchcraft. What do you equate that to?
Well, it certainly is virtually a universal belief. Almost every culture around the world has a belief in some type of magical practice, or what is colloquially referred to as witchcraft, although that technically refers to European folk magic. But it's kind of broadly a used term to refer to any type of folk magical practices or practices of magic by indigenous people. And so it is a universally held belief system, the belief in witches, that there are supernatural beings which may be their neighbors, or maybe appear to be simple human beings, but in fact that they have supernatural powers, and they're associated with a variety of different religious and spiritual belief systems. But the idea that there are individuals that have these specific powers is really consistent with what parapsychology studies, because really what parapsychology has done is take a traditional belief system that's almost universal and a set of traditional experiences that people have reported throughout human history, and they've essentially given it a more scientific veneer. What people used to call magic, we now call psychokinesis. You know, what people used to call divination, we now call ESP. But it's really the same thing. And so that's why I think that given the ancient traditions associated with these practices and with these beliefs, that parapsychologists and psychologists may have a lot to learn by looking at the practices and beliefs associated with these magical phenomena, to find out if there are ways that we can use these practices or these belief systems to enhance our own understanding and even practical application of these little known human abilities.
Where do you stand on that belief? Do you believe in magic, as many of us have, you know, think of when we consider witchcraft or magical arts? Do you believe that does exist?
I do. You have to be very specific with your definition of terms. You know, for me, I mean, magic has been defined in a number of different ways. One of the best definitions is the science of causing change to occur in the internal or external environment by means of the will. That's a fairly commonly held definition, and I also like the definition simply that that magic is simply the practical application of little known abilities of the mind, and in that sense it's very consistent with what parapsychologists study, and very consistent with what many psychologists study in terms of altered states of consciousness, for example, trance states. These things are almost always associated, these states of consciousness are almost always associated with the practice of magic. So in that sense, I I absolutely do believe. I believe that people are able to cause action at a distance through the use of their thoughts alone under certain very specific circumstances, and I believe that people are able to receive information from distant sources through this process that used to be called magic and which now we call psi or ESP. So I certainly do believe in it.
I think we've all seen things and have had experiences in one way, shape, or another that are listening to the show and fascinated by the paranormal that we would put down in a sense of being magical, whether it's just that moment, that connection, that spark, or thinking of something, and then the phone rings and it's that person you were just thinking of. I mean, do you put that into kind of the realm of the magical as well, or is that just something that's I guess we want to use the term paranormal so easily. Is it really outside the normal, or is that really the normal? Is that always going on around us and should be considered natural?
I think it is. I think the term paranormal is really something of a misnomer, and so is the term supernatural, because I think that everything that exists is part of nature, and even though there may be aspects of nature that we poorly understand, they're still part of the natural universe in some sense, and I think you're absolutely right. So many people report these experiences and these beliefs throughout virtually every culture in human history, and the same is true today, that I think it's not really accurate to refer to them as paranormal. They are anomalous in the sense that they don't happen to us every single day. But for many cultures around the world, it's taken for granted that there is another world that coexists with ours and that with which we come into contact from time to time. And that's just taken as a matter of course. It's only in the Western technological cultures that we tend to ridicule and minimize or devalue those experiences and beliefs. And I think that's a mistake. I think we have a lot to learn from these belief systems and from these practices. You know, parapsychologists are always seeking ways in which we can enhance our psi abilities, because although the experiments conducted in laboratory research certainly are pretty conclusive in terms of the fact that ESP does exist, and to a lesser degree, that it's less conclusive, but still very suggestive that psychokinesis also exists. But the reality is that there have been cultures throughout human history and still are today that regularly at least claim to apply these abilities successfully and have methodologies established over centuries for doing so. So I think it would be beneficial to us to look at these practices and see what we can learn. What is it exactly that they're doing and how are they doing it? And that way we can perhaps gain more control over these, what I believe to be natural human abilities.
Well, you believe that. I believe that. A lot of our listeners believe that. But why is it that science still takes such a hard-edged nose look at these points and won't accept that this is part of reality? What is the loss to them, or what is the egg on their face to look at something that so many people believe in and say, okay, there's something to this?
Well, that's a complex question, and I think you're right. I think the official agents of our culture, which are here in the Western world, are the scientists, the churches, and the mainstream media. I think all three of these agents of culture tend to minimize or dismiss paranormal claims out of hand. Although, as you said, there's an enormous popular interest and belief in it, and these experiences are widely reported, and yet they're underreported and understudied and de-emphasized by the official agents of culture. And it's difficult to say why. I think that in part it has to do with just a materialistic Western worldview that dominates Western science since the Enlightenment. Materialism and reductionism has tended to dominate Western scientific thought, and I think that the other agents of culture tend to fall in line behind the scientists who have become the high priests of our culture. And I think part of it is also that, you know, for centuries the church and superstition dominated the lives of human beings. I think it took science a very long time to overcome the stigma associated with science itself, and they are fearful of our culture regressing back to this, you know, what they regard as a superstitious, savage belief system. And so I think that that fear of the loss of the prestige of science over the prestige of religion and spirituality, which is what used to dominate Western culture and still dominates many parts of the world, I think their fear of the loss of that status and prestige is part of it. And I think the fact that they truly have adopted a very materialistic worldview. It can't happen because it's impossible. But to me, that is not a scientific attitude. A true scientific attitude should be open to all possibilities and all experiences to the degree that they can be tested. That's what science really is about, is testing these experiences, testing the hypothesis to find out if, in fact, there's something to it.
When you look at things like witchcraft and magic, then, are there any actual tested beliefs that really stand up? And even to this date, we can look at it scientifically and say there is something here. There is definitely something extraordinary that happened that is outside of the normal perceptions of reality.
Well, I mean, we look at it this way. I mean, first of all, you have to think about what constitutes science. Traditionally, science is defined as a method of knowing, which is based on empirical evidence, which is direct observation and experimentation. And if you look at the occult traditions of various societies, including the Western esoteric or occult tradition, and other traditions like the tantric system, the Eastern traditions as well. Again, it's a worldwide phenomenon, but there are various traditions associated with it. If you look at these traditions, what you see is that their practices have been rigorously scientific. In other words, they have conducted these experiments. They have performed these rituals, and they have gotten results consistently. And this has been reported again and again and again in cultures all over the world. And the results that they've obtained, although much greater, much more significant results, at least that's what they claim, are also consistent with the results obtained by parapsychologists. You know, the parapsychologists, again, 150 years ago, during the height of the materialistic scientific revolution, the mechanistic scientific revolution, things like ESP and psychokinesis would have been regarded as magic. That's how they would have been described. Certainly anybody who exhibits psychic abilities of any kind or psychokinetic abilities like poltergeist agents would have been regarded as witches or wizards 200 years ago, 300 years ago. So I think that in many ways, parapsychology is the science of magic. It's the scientific discipline, the Western scientific discipline, which attempts to bridge the Western scientific materialistic worldview with the more popular universal spiritualist worldview that is still prevalent for most people in the world today. You know, it's funny. I've been to conferences overseas with psychologists and other scientists, and I've asked them these questions. These are prominent, brilliant, well-educated men and women, and I've asked them questions such as, do you believe in witchcraft? Do you believe in demons? Do you believe in spirits? And virtually universally, they say, oh, yes, absolutely. I absolutely believe in them. You know, they see no contradiction between their science and these belief systems. And given the universal nature of these beliefs and the universal nature of these experiences, I think it is well worth a scientific look at what exactly these individuals and these groups are doing. What effect do these rituals have? Does it have a specific method by which you can focus and concentrate and direct these little known innate human abilities? And I think that they do. I think they do. So I think it works. I don't think it works all the time. And I don't think it works as well as many of the stories describe, because like everything else in legend, it tends to be inflated and exaggerated over time. But I do think that magic works. And I think that there are whole whole volumes of psychiatric material on so-called hex death or voodoo death, where people have been cursed or hexed and have actually died with no obvious physiological problem. This generally happens in indigenous countries and tribal societies and third world countries, but not always. Sometimes it happens in the Western world too. And there have been many scientific papers in psychiatric journals published on these cases. But of course, they're almost always attributed simply to autosuggestion, that if a person believes they're going to die, then basically their own mind kills them. That's the theory. But then if you look at the studies that have been done in recent years, for example, on the power of prayer and the reality that prayer appears to work even when the experimental group is not aware that they're being prayed for. And so theoretically, then, you could say negative prayer or destructive prayer could also work in the same way. And it would not necessarily require autosuggestion in order for this to work. So the reality is it's probably a combination of both. That it's probably, traditional magicians and sorcerers tend to use a combination of psychological and parapsychological techniques to obtain the effects that they're seeking.
Is the idea, the Secret was such a big book and DVD a few years ago, the idea of setting intention and calling upon the universe, is that just a new age version of witchcraft and magic, in your opinion?
I do. I absolutely do. I mean, so much of this material has been repackaged and remarketed as if it were something new. In fact, I've always objected to the whole term of new age, because there's nothing new about any of this stuff, and many of the practices which are taken for granted today would certainly have been regarded as magic not too very long ago. For example, Reiki. Almost every town now has a few Reiki practitioners, and some towns and cities have a lot of them, and they're fairly reasonably well accepted and integrated into the alternative medical community. And variations of this, such as therapeutic touch, non-contact healing, is being used by many registered nurses, and registered nurses can obtain continuing education units for studying therapeutic touch. It's basically the same. It's used in some hospitals, and it's essentially the same thing as Reiki. Well, Reiki is nothing more or less than Japanese ritual magic. I mean, that's exactly what it is. And so an awful lot of these things have simply been repackaged to make them more palatable to the Western ear and mind, but they're in fact just ancient magical traditions.
Well, is it really magical, the Eastern functionality of a lot of this? Because it just seems to me it's science that we just haven't looked at or accepted, right? It's the idea that moving energy, which we know we are, science admits it, quantum physics knows that we're energy. All that it seems with the Eastern culture is that they've understand and get how to tap into these energy streams and change the course of these paths in order to help us with health and mental awareness and acuity. Is that really magical, or is it just an understanding of what really is going on?
Well, the two are not mutually exclusive. I think that, again, magic is just a term that has been denigrated, but essentially means exactly what you just described. So, I don't know what the difference would be, whether you call it magic or whether you call it distant, direct mental influence of living systems, or DeMills, as some parapsychologists use that term. I mean, there are a lot of different terms that have been used, but essentially, as far as I can tell, I don't see the difference between that and magic. It's essentially exactly the same effects and procedures that are being described. They're just given a different name that makes it a little more palatable for Western ears.
The idea that we can influence people, influence objects, you've got the spoon benders out there, right? You've got Uri Geller, who is still topical. He's still in the news. There's articles being released about him recently that, the CIA was involved in research and study with him and all these other things. And the guy has made a career of doing this. Now, is there a difference between mentalism and magic in these senses, or is it kind of an interchangeable topic, just depending on who the audience is that you're playing to.
That's right. I think that's exactly what it is, although I wouldn't use the word mentalism, because mentalism, at least as the term is used currently, refers to a type of stage magic which simulates psychic phenomena, you know, such as, you know, the amazing Kreskin, for example, Chris Angel. I mean, these people are mentalists, and so their idea is to, you know, it's a whole branch of stage magic or illusion which is designed to simulate psychic phenomena, including psychokinesis. But no, your point's well taken, and it's true. There's absolutely no difference between assuming that what Uri Geller does is genuine psychokinesis, to use the parapsychological term. I don't see any difference between that and magic. I think it's exactly the same thing.
There's and I wish I could remember, but it was during World War II, I believe, the witches of England got together at one point when there was a blitzkrieg on its way towards them, an attack, and these witches gathered and called forth incantation, spells, intention, whatever you want to call it, and it turned this tide of this oncoming storm of hell to England away. That's been well documented, and I'm sure you have more familiarity with that than I do, and it's escaping my mind right now, but do you know the story I'm talking about?
I do. It's sometimes referred to as the Magical Battle of Britain, and there were actually several different groups that were involved. Gerald Gardner, who's regarded as the founder of the Wicca religion, was one group that was involved in this, but then also, more famously, Dion Fortune and her Society of the Inner Light, many of whose members were separated by considerable distances as a result of the difficulty in traveling during World War II. And so Dion Fortune kept communication with these folks by letter. So she would send out letters to the various members in which they would agree that on a particular time, on a particular date, they would all be focusing their intention on a particular object to a particular member of the German high command for the purpose of changing their minds about a particular attack or changing the course of the war, as you said. And they had this went on for several years. It was an ongoing process that was done by occultists all over Britain, including, again, most famously, Dion Fortune, but also Gerald Gardner.
The idea that this kind of combination of forces could change and alter the parameters of even war. There are many people. I mean, the hippie movement of the 60s, an example, you had millions of people focused on the same idea, peace, love, and getting laid. And that happened a lot. But I don't know about the peace and love so much, Dr. Nichols. I mean, why wasn't that intention strong enough?
Well, the war did end.
Right, you know? But in what year? It took how many years to get there, and the war would have ended eventually anyway.
Yeah, that's true, and that's one of the problems with magic. And there are a couple of problems in studying this stuff. One is the fact that people have the wrong idea about how magic works. There are basically three kinds of magic. There's lesser magic, which includes autosuggestion, hypnosis, and other forms of altered states of consciousness. Subtle psychological manipulation. And this would also include bioenergetic manipulation like Reiki and non-contact healing, therapeutic touch, and so on, mesmerism. These things would fall into the category of lesser magic. Then you have ritual magic. And this is the kind that I think has the most promise. But then the third type is sometimes referred to as high magic. And high magic is legendary. In other words, I've never met anybody who could actually do high magic. High magic is what you find in legends around the world of sorcerers and magicians who are able to do incredible feats of levitation. For example, Merlin levitating the stones of Stonehenge from Wales and that type of thing. These types of legends persist around the world, and which gives them a certain credence that you know, could there actually have been individuals who had that type of power, you know, real Harry Potter stuff. If so, they're well hidden because they're extinct. I've never found anyone who was able to do anything like that today. But that doesn't mean that those abilities did not once exist. Doesn't mean it does either. It could be that it's purely legend. But you know, given that I have witnessed poltergeist cases in which very large objects weighing several hundred pounds have been moved by this force that we call psychokinesis, and many parapsychologists, myself included, believe that the evidence is strong that this force is linked to the unconscious mind of one or more individuals in the environment, whether there's a separate entity involved in some cases or not, there is distinctly a link with the unconscious minds of certain individuals. So if there is this ability that certain individuals can subconsciously channel and create these effects that we call the poltergeist, then why isn't it possible that with the proper training and method, we might be able to access this ability consciously? And it could be that in ancient times, those methods of training and application were known, and maybe they're still known today. Maybe they are, in fact, guarded by a secret few in some monastery in Tibet or something. I don't know. I just know I've never seen it. So that is an interesting area of exploration, and it, again, the parapsychological evidence seems to support that such an ability could exist. Whether it ever was under conscious control of certain individuals or not, we don't know. But then when you talk about ritual magic, it's a little bit different, because in ritual magic, the idea is to create an alternate reality on another plane of existence, which they usually refer to as the astral plane. And they do this by training their will and their imagination. Essentially, what they're training themselves to do is to induce a kind of trance, a kind of self-hypnosis through ritual, in which they are able to strongly visualize certain events. And they're able to focus their own emotions very powerfully, because it's more than just the secret of magic is visualization plus emotional charge. And so if you're able to visualize something strongly enough and frequently enough, and you're able to infuse it or charge it with a powerful emotion, and you do that repeatedly through this ritual process, then ultimately this will manifest itself or might manifest itself on the physical plane. It's sort of trickle-down effect. It manifests from higher realms to lower realms. That's the magical theory. So you create the images on the higher realms, and then they filter down to the lower realms. But this is a much more subtle and long-term manifestation. It doesn't occur instantly in the way that the Harry Potter type high magic would. So it'd be much more subtle, and things can interfere with it. For example, other people's wills. You know, if you have a group of individuals who are trying to create a group mind or egregore for the purpose of having a magical effect on the environment, then it's important that these individuals all be of one mind and all be equally well trained, because otherwise then their stray thoughts and their opinions, which may differ from yours, may interfere with this ability. So the only way you can successfully have a group ritual and expect it to work is if everybody is exactly on the same level and are able to strongly visualize and emotionally charge these images. And when you're dealing with, you were talking about the hippie movement, when you're dealing with thousands of people that are really untrained, mm-hmm. You have a lot of people's wills working against one another. And so I think that type of thing prevents any likelihood of real manifestation to occur. At least that's what the Western esoteric theory or Western magical theory would hold. And it's consistent with what we know about the way parapsychological experiences and abilities work. So I do think there's something to be learned from this.
All right. Our guest this evening, Dr. Andrew Nichols, as we're talking about witchcraft and magic from a parapsychological perspective. That's our topic tonight. Tomorrow, Vanquishing Ghosts and Demons, we'll be talking with Sandrea Massis, who's going to share some very weird stories of her own work in the field of trying to rid people of attachments and connections to the paranormal. That's tomorrow night. And remember, if you like what you hear on the show and there are guests and topics you'd like us to cover, you can always email me those suggestions to dave@darknessradio.com. Dave@darknessradio.com. com. It's that simple. Just send me the information. And it always helps if you have links to the guests, if you know how to contact them, communicate with them, emails, websites, any of that information. We always try to look into that. You can email those to me and I'll forward them on to my producer Booker Amy, and she will try to get them listed on the show as soon as possible. We love your insights. We love to know what type of topics you're interested in, and we'd like to hear more from you.
Beyond the Darkness.
Dr. Andrew Nichols, our guest here this evening on Beyond the Darkness. And we're talking about magic and witchcraft and how it all looks from a parapsychological aspect. Is there a psychology to magic, Dr. Nichols? Is there something that we can map in the brain that when somebody's wishing or focusing with intent on that, that there's parts of the brain that light up or something that we can look at under a microscope to say, see, there is a change. There is a difference when we put this together.
Well, certainly there is with prayer and with meditation. As far as I know, those technologies have not been applied to this, to magicians or the practitioners of magic. But essentially, certainly the whole relatively new field of neurotheology is about brain mapping people who are in the midst of numinous or spiritual or religious experiences, and they've used Zen monks and they've used nuns, Catholic nuns, in the midst of prayer, people who are experienced in prayer and meditation, to find out exactly what parts of the brain are active. And normally it's the temporal lobes, it's the amygdala, hippocampus, parts of the midbrain, the primitive mammalian brain or limbic system that tend to light up, and of course the pineal body, which is often regarded as sort of the antenna or the third eye for these abilities. So certainly there has been some research done. Serena Roney Dugal did a lot of research on the connections between paranormal and magical experiences and the pineal gland in the brain. And so there has been some research done, not nearly enough. But I do believe that there is a psychology to magic. I think that again, by looking at the practices of people who are engaged in magical systems, we can learn a lot about exactly what they're doing and look for the commonalities. For example, all forms of magic seem to consist of three basic components, which in the tantric system are referred to as mudra, mantra, and mandala, the three M's. The mudra are gestures made with the hands and the body. The mantras are magical words or words that are spoken verbally. And mandalas are specific symbols or sigils that are used to symbolically represent some aspect of the other world or specific entities or beings that they're trying to communicate with. And you find these three components in virtually all forms of magic around the world.
Doesn't that fascinate you, though, Dr. Nichols? Who created it? Who knew that this design would encompass this or would maybe bind that? I mean, it just seems to me so fascinating. It's like, who looked at a lobster and said, I'd eat that, right? All I have to do is throw it in boiling water, crack it open, and I can eat it. Where do these ideas come from that words have these kind of meanings and power behind them, and that by incanting these words or drawing these symbols, this will, you know, bear fruit in a positive way, negative way, a protective way? It just seems like it's there. It existed. It always existed. And there's no real history to where the origins of those came from.
Well, and that's true. And it's not a question that certainly can be answered scientifically. You know, it depends on your worldview. You know, some people believe it came from ancient astronauts, and, you know, some people believe that it's part of our spiritual evolution, our evolutionary heritage from the spiritual world, that we innately know this knowledge at a deep spiritual level, and that occasionally through the through trance practices and meditation and so forth, we can gain intuitive insights into aspects of the universe that you couldn't discover through purely observation or experimental means alone. But the answer really is that nobody knows where it came from originally, but it does seem to be universal.
We know that there's power in words, and we're learning more about that now. And it seems silly that it's taken so long for us as a culture to realize that our personal talk with the way we talk to ourselves and talk to others can affect them. And in a sense, that is magic, because it is an incantation. When you sit there convincing yourself, I'm too stupid, I'm too fat, I'm too old, I'm too bald, I'm too this, I'm too that, and you speak this negativity, you set into motion the reality of those thoughts. And people can tell me all day long, no, that doesn't happen. Well, it does happen. That's why you can sit there and look at somebody who's extremely successful, who's fat, bald, ugly, and you know, had no money. But how did they suddenly turn it around? Well, they didn't buy into that philosophy. They looked at it as a different point. And that is the magic in those words and in the self-talk. And, you know, we've all got this inherent self-loathing that seems to hold us back from really excelling and moving beyond what people might consider normal realms. You know, you said, is some of this magic dead? Have we lost it to time? And I often think we're not that far removed from understanding right now that energy is all around us, and that we are connected through energy, and that we can move things with energy, right? We can clean with the sound of sonics. We can, you know, peel paint off with water. We can do amazing things in the way we manipulate energy. So the idea that we could lift rocks with our consciousness doesn't seem so far removed. That 100 monkeys in Zanzibar can suddenly start using a balloon as a tool, and suddenly monkeys in a totally different aspect of the world become globally aware of this thought and are able to implement that thought. Science has proven that time and again. So it really seems like we're not that far away from being able to exercise and grasp the concept of magic and start to put it to work in reality.
I think that's absolutely true. And I think that one of the secrets that you find that's used universally in magical practice is the concept of personification of these forces. In other words, I think that one of the problems with the Western scientific method is it depersonifies these natural and psychological forces, turns them into abstractions. And I think they're very difficult to manipulate in the form of an abstraction. But if you look at what practitioners of magic do, they personify these forces. In other words, when you ask the question, what are gods and goddesses and demons and spirits? And what they are, essentially, is they are personifications of natural and psychological forces. Now, you know, we don't know whether they were personified before or whether we personify them. You can argue that all day. You know, the ontological status of these entities is really not a resolvable question. But what you can say is that by personifying them, that focuses and directs this energy that you're talking about. And every type of magical practice uses this method of creating in the mind's eye, in the imagination, very strong, well-defined, condensed personifications repeatedly of these various forces, which, again, we think of as beings, or the practitioners think of as beings, as gods, as goddesses. That's why magical practice is so closely linked to religious practice. And I think that that is one of the secrets of where the power lies. In other words, as long as you're trying to depersonify it, which is what Western science does, tries to reduce it to an abstract force, then it's extremely diffuse and difficult to manipulate. So you can think of it as being diffuse like sunlight. But by using ritual and personification, you can focus and direct that force just like a small child uses a magnifying glass to direct the diffuse rays of the sun to start a fire in a pile of leaves. It's the same principle, that you're using the mind to focus and concentrate this ability, but you can do that most successfully if you personify those forces. It gives you something to visualize, something to hold on to as an object, to objectify it, in other words, as a god or a goddess or a spirit. And that's why I think that religion and the belief in these types of beings is so closely allied to the practice of magic. Even in the Catholic Church and in other churches, although they would probably vigorously disagree, but in my opinion, the High Mass is nothing more or less than ceremonial magic. And most of these practices, they derive from earlier pagan practices. And these practices have power. Although most practitioners today, most priests and ministers are no longer trained in these methods of visualization and condensing of these thought forms, these images. And so, you know, just standing there and going through the motions and making the gestures and saying the words in and of itself has very little power. It has to be done in a very specific way. And it used to be that priests were trained to do it this way. You know, the so-called method of St. Ignatius of Loyola, the founder of the Jesuits, which he called the composition of place, where he trained his priests to visualize biblical scenes, for example, and very strongly in their prayers and in their meditations, and to put themselves into those scenes, that they actually were creating a very realistic, over time, you can condense this image to create a very realistic scene. But it takes training. You have to train your mind to do that. You can't just get a book from Barnes & Noble and read a few words and expect that this is going to have an effect or make a few gestures or draw a pentagram or whatever. It takes years of training of the mind to be able to properly visualize and condense these images. And that's really how magic has to be practiced. And that's how it was practiced traditionally. As with shamanism, the magical apprentice had to go through years of training of their mind in order to be able to focus and direct these diffuse energies.
It's, you know, I'd love to understand this more. I'd love to wrap my head around it. You know, you've done a lot with poltergeist stories and cases where, as you said earlier, you've seen massive things move. But in these experiments and in these experiences, why is there not a measurable quantitative science that's taking place, where this energy is emanating from, where it began, where it ended? There doesn't seem to be any response. We can hypothesize that it's happening around a quote unquote poltergeist agent, which might be a young teenage girl or boy or a menopausal woman or whatever the case is that we believe is the focal point on this. But has there been any actual scientific data to back up the fact that this person is what's causing this situation?
Well, there certainly has been a considerable amount of research done, but most of it is inconclusive. I mean, in the case of the poltergeist, it still boils down to the same question, the sort of the animistic hypothesis versus the spiritistic hypothesis. In other words, is this an innate power of a living human being that is unconsciously channeling and directing this power for psychological purposes? And that's sort of the Western parapsychological view of RSPK, recurrent spontaneous psychokinesis. And then the other hypothesis, of course, the spiritistic hypothesis, there's some type of an entity that has attached itself to this individual. This individual is a medium, is a latent medium, and it's drawing on the individual's energy and emotional turbulence to fuel the poltergeist phenomena, but that there is a separate non-physical, non-corporeal entity involved. And the reality is there appears to be both types of cases. And sometimes we call these type 1 or type 2 poltergeists, where the type 1 case seems to be more psychokinetic, having to do with a particular individual, and the phenomena tends to be less dynamic. And then the type 2 case, which there appears to be some type of an entity involved. But the reality is it's very, very difficult to tell. In other words, how do we know that this entity is not a personification from the agent, from the individual's own unconscious mind? And as far as I can tell, there is no way to know for sure. And it may not really matter. You know, in the practice of in magical practice, you work on the as if hypothesis. In other words, you behave as if these entities were what they appear to be. They may appear to be spirits of the dead. They may appear to be angels or demons or extraterrestrial beings or whatever they might appear to be. They appear to be very fluid in how they appear. And the reality is we don't know what their ultimate origin is. But if we behave as if they were what they seem to be, then it seems to be possible to direct those forces that they represent, whether they are separate individual entities or not, is kind of a moot point from a practical standpoint. And modern practitioners of magic, and of which there are still many ritual magic practitioners, most of them understand that what they're doing is personifying forces, and they don't bother themselves with the question of whether these forces are independent entities or not. The reality is that they behave as if they are, and it works. And so when it's a practical methodology, then you don't necessarily have to question it too closely. But I really don't think there is any scientific way to distinguish one way or the other. And in terms of measuring these energies, we have tried. But it appears to be, in some sense, electromagnetic, but that does not account for the movement of these objects. Of course, you have non-metallic, non-ferrous, non-magnetic objects that move in poltergeist cases. So it can't just be manipulation of electromagnetism, and yet there appears to be an electromagnetic, sometimes measurable electromagnetic component to these experiences. So there's certainly a source of energy here that we have not been able to trace, at least using any technology that's currently available.
Isn't that frustrating then? It doesn't seem we're really any further in understanding the spiritualism and this exchange of energy than they were in the 1800s during the height of that spiritualism movement. You know, there's no way to quantify a lot of this energy exchange. There's no way to prove that it exists. We have theories and pontifications, but there's nothing solid to back any of these ideas up.
And you're right. From the standpoint of Western science, you're absolutely right. There is no conclusive evidence that's going to convince a hardened skeptic and well-informed skeptic that these things actually occur. The only thing that you can do, I disagree, though, that it's not possible to study it scientifically. It may not be possible to measure it technologically at this stage of our development. But I do believe you can study these things scientifically using the methods of social science. In other words, if you find people who do have these abilities, practitioners, for example, of magic, or shamans, or oracles, people who have these abilities, people who are able to consistently demonstrate these types of abilities, then you can study what it is that they're doing. And by doing so, you can bring that practice into the laboratories. In other words, if it takes personification in order to make it work, then you train people to do this. I mean, you can involve Western technology in the training process, such as biofeedback, for example. You discover that particular brain waves are associated with the practices, with the successful practice of magic. Then you could train people using biofeedback to produce those brain waves at will. So we can certainly involve Western technology in the process of training, but I think we have to look to these indigenous and traditional methods of training in order to be able to reproduce it sufficiently that we can demonstrate it with great accuracy and with definitiveness. That's really what we're looking for. And so we may not be able to measure the force that's involved. You know, people used electricity for a very, very long time and still do for all sorts of things without really understanding what the nature of electricity is. We still don't completely understand what it is. I've asked physicists to explain exactly what magnetism is, and they admit, frankly, they don't know what it is. They can explain the properties of magnetism very accurately, but what actually is it? And they don't know. They don't know what it is. There's it's some effect that distorts space in a certain way so that certain types of objects are attracted, and they know, again, many of the properties that cause this to happen, but they can't tell you what it is in its essence. So I think the same could be true for this psychokinetic force or magical force, whatever you want to call it, that we can learn how to manipulate it theoretically and control it without necessarily ever knowing what its actual essence is. And maybe we will or maybe we won't, but that's not necessarily a prerequisite to learning to control it.
Is there any aspect of the idea of magic or witchcraft that you've seen in person that has impressed you enough to believe that the true magic, as it's been, you know, positioned in literature and in drama, actually exists? And what are those examples for you?
Well, I've certainly seen cases of psychic experiences during rituals conducted in Haiti, for example, during Budun rituals, in which they were able to get information that they did not and could not have known, in my opinion, that they were able to relate to me about the illness of my father, for example, which they had no way of knowing. And so I've certainly seen psychism displayed that way. I haven't, as I've said before, I haven't seen any evidence of high magic in the sense of, you know, floating rocks through the air or something like that in ritual. I have not seen that take place. But I certainly have had personal experience in magical ritual for healing purposes that seems to have had a remarkably positive effect. Again, very, very difficult to pin this down precisely. You can always argue that these things are, in some sense, due to sensory leakage, even if the individual doesn't know that they're the subject of this magical ritual. But, of course, most of the time they do know. So you can't rule out the effect of autosuggestion and so on. So it's all blended together. The psychology is blended together with the parapsychology, and it's very, very difficult to sort it out. But certainly I've seen people that were suffering under curses and hexes. But again, you can explain this in psychological terms theoretically. But given what we know from laboratory research in parapsychology, I think it's reasonable to suppose that there is an additional factor that also plays a role in both healing and hexing. And how you would separate those two, separate the psychological variables from the parapsychological variables, we're not going to be able to do that until we understand more about how the parapsychological phenomena actually work, how these psychic or paranormal forces actually work.
The idea that people encounter ghosts, loved ones, messages from beyond, we don't give ourselves nearly enough credit for just how powerful we are as a person and projection. Do you believe that in most cases, the visitations of ghosts, whether it's perceived or visual, is nothing more than a projection from our own psyche and our own memory of this moment of what we want or need in order to heal? Because, you know, as a psychologist, the body has remarkable ways to deal with pain and distress and anguish and grief. Could that be just a part of the healing process?
Well, it certainly is. I mean, psychologists call those types of visitation apparitions, they call them bereavement hallucinations, because so many people who have lost loved ones, widows and widowers, report having post-mortem contact with their deceased loved ones. So certainly, again, it's almost impossible to completely isolate the psychological aspects from the psychic or paranormal aspects, because the two go hand in hand. I don't think you can have one with it unless there's a powerful, you know, from what we know about ESP in the laboratory, ESP is an emotionally driven phenomenon. In other words, you have to be strongly motivated in order for it to work properly. And things like love and hate and grief are powerful motivators. So it's very difficult to artificially reproduce those emotional variables in a laboratory situation. And I think that's one of the reasons why these phenomena are so much stronger when you hear about them or see them in the wild, in the day-to-day life of human beings, they're so much of a stronger effect than they are in the laboratory because of that emotional aspect of it. But I also think that we may be asking the wrong question. You know, I don't think it's necessarily an either-or question. You're asking whether these ghosts could simply be projections of the unconscious mind. Yes, they could. But if they are, does that rule out that the consciousness of the dead also may play a role in it? No, it doesn't rule it out. You know, it may be a combination of both. You know, George Turrell's theory of apparitions, published many years ago, which is probably the most scientific study of apparitions ever done. And that's what he concluded, that basically that there is an agent and there is a percipient, and that the person who sees the ghost, their unconscious mind is responsible for creating the image itself. It's essentially a projected hallucination, but it is a projected hallucination in response to a telepathic signal, if you will, from another mind. And the other mind may be a living person or it may be a dead person. So an apparition in his theory is essentially a collaboration between the unconscious mind of the person who sees the ghost and the conscious or unconscious mind of the person who is seen as the ghost. And that person may be either living or dead. So it's a collaborative effort. I think if parapsychology has taught us anything, it is that the idea of the encapsulated self, the isolated mind, is a false idea. It's an illusion, that we really aren't isolated one from another. And so if you have a loved one who has died, then your consciousness at one point when that person was alive, your consciousness intertwined with the consciousness of that person, even when you weren't in physical proximity to one another. And now that they're dead, your consciousness may still intertwine with the consciousness of that deceased individual, even though their physical bodies are no longer there. So if ESP can work while you're alive, there's no reason that it couldn't work while you're dead. But I do believe that the unconscious mind of the person who sees the ghost or the apparition plays a powerful role, plays a strong role in the appearance of the apparition. And that's why ghosts tend to wear clothes and so forth. It's because they're seen as the person would see them. You know, normally the person is remembered as being clothed, and so they're seen in the way that they were remembered. And in the case of someone you've never known, they're often wearing clothes of another era, for example. And again, I think this is because it's a type of memory impression, but it's a telepathic charge that's picked up by the mind of the person who sees the ghost, and then their mind generates the image. So, and not everybody agrees with this theory, because if that theory is true, then how do you explain the photographs that seem to show ghosts? Because if it's an image that's generated in the mind of the recipient, then it should not be photographable. How do you explain EVPs? Again, very difficult to do. But it's also true that I've looked at thousands of ghost photographs and listened to thousands of EVPs, and I find very few of them very convincing. So it could be that ghosts are real and that spirits are real, but maybe they really can't be photographed or recorded because they are impressions in the mind's eye only. But that doesn't mean that they're not real. It just means that they are experienced subjectively, but that they still have a separate independent existence of their own. It's just non-physical. So it's a complex question. You know, it makes us reevaluate our understanding of reality and our understanding of what we mean by the word mind.
I've looked at something. I grew up Lutheran, going to Trinity Lutheran Grade School in Roselle, and I've always had a fascination with the idea of religion and a God, Christ, and the story. And I know this will put me in the heretical charge, and I'm sure I'll get a lot of email and angry email about this, but I often looked at the Bible as a book of spells, a book of incantations, prayers that we're supposed to recite over and over again to create miracles, to create things to happen. We're told by the word of Christ and his apostles that these are things that we're all capable of. and that we have this ability, and that when we raise our voices together more than one, when two or three of us come together, we're more powerful than ever. To me, it seems like maybe if this was looked at, not in the nefarious black magic witch coven way that people would automatically assume, but I often wonder if we started to look at the true Bible code, is the Bible nothing more than a series of incantations and magic spells in order to live the life that we were promised?
Well, I think certainly part of it is. I think that, you know, the Bible is a very complex document, and of course it isn't simply one book, but it's many books, you know, written over centuries, separated by centuries. So it is a combination of history and myth and magic. There's definitely magic in there, but I think you're right, and certainly the Bible has been used and is used currently as a magical text. By many people. Here in the American South, we have practitioners of hoodoo, which is not the same as voodoo. Voodoo is a religion. Hoodoo is a folk magical practice. Most practitioners of hoodoo in the American South would regard themselves as good Christians, and they often use the Bible in their incantations and in their practice of magic. Up in the North, you have the practitioners of powwow in the Pennsylvania Dutch country, which is the same thing. It incorporates a lot of Western European ceremonial magic, but the practitioners of it almost universally regard themselves as Christian, not as pagans, and they certainly use the Bible in the same way, in a magical way. So certainly there are traditions that regard the Bible and the traditional practices of Christianity as being magical and having magical powers. You know, it's just, again, it's sort of the Western more modernistic churches tend to de-emphasize or deny that aspect of it. But anybody who looks at the history of Christianity sees that it's full of magic, that these things are indistinguishable. They just don't like the term magic. But these practices from the earliest church up until fairly recently, and still in many parts of the world, are intrinsically magical and are virtually identical to the practices of pagan societies as well. So I think the Bible is full of magic, and you're right. I think that I'll probably get some negative comments because of that, because of the stereotype, because of the stigma that people attach to the word magic. But I think essentially that is what it is.
Right. We have people coming back from the dead, people being raised, people being healed. You know, even the magic in the numbers of certain things and how people come together and uniting together, creating a purpose, creating a magic about them. You know, Christ turning water into wine and one loaf of bread and one fish into many to feed the world. Now, some will say those are parables, but is it also part of the idea that we are so much more than we give ourselves credit for, and that if we open the paradigm of possibilities instead of limiting ourselves, you know, Christ basically said, hey, I've got this power. God gave me this power. You have the power. The idea is that you get locked into your own mindset. You know, I tell this story, and I've tried to share it with my children, and I think once or twice through the years on Darkness Radio. I had a great friend named Phil Spazzeri in high school. Short little Italian guy, built like a marble statue, could do everything. You know, he could sing, play instruments. He was an amazing artist. He was an intelligent student. He was a great athlete. And I remember in the hallway one day, this dissertation between him and or confrontation between him and somebody else. Phil was flirting with this guy's girlfriend, and the guy got all up on Phil. And he's a big, burly football player, probably two times the size of Phil, and starts making all of these nasty comments, and you conceited little prick, and I could crush you, and da da da. And Phil said, let me stop you there. See, right away, you've got the wrong idea about me. You called me conceited. I just want to inform you of one thing. Since I was born, I've been told how amazing I am, how good looking I am, what a great athlete I am, what a great student I am, how amazing I am at art and music and everything that I do. And I think what you need in your life is somebody that believes in you the way the people in my life believe in me, because you understand I'm not conceited, I'm convinced. And this guy could walk through fire. He was so mentally centered. It was amazing. And this was a high school kid who had the grasp and concept of oneness, of believing in what you're able to do. And he, you know, he pushed himself to the limits on everything. And it always astounded me the calm, cool collectedness this kid had and his grasp and concept of things that were much bigger than we ever were at 14 and 15 years old. But that stuck with me for a long time, and I've often thought, I wonder if that's all Jesus was saying, is that get over your own limitations. Get over believing the dogma and stigma of what other people put on you. You're not limited by what other people write about you. You're limited by what you put yourself into, what your history is that you write for yourself.
Well, I certainly think the implication is there, again, depending on how much credence you give to Scripture. You know, certainly the kingdom of heaven is within you. These things shall you do also, and greater than this shall you do. There certainly are many hints in the Bible and suggestions that each of us are capable of extraordinary things. But we have to believe, as you said, the belief makes all the difference in the world. And that is true for the practice of magic too. Part of the training of the magician is learning to, again, create these imaginal realms in their minds through practice and meditation, and learning to believe in the reality of these personifications. And they actually are able to compartmentalize. I mean, some of them are you know, in tribal cultures and indigenous cultures, pretty much everyone intrinsically believes in this stuff because that's part of their culture. In Western society, it's much more difficult because we're all indoctrinated into this scientific, mechanistic worldview. And so in our society, we have to sort of compartmentalize our minds so that we're able to shift into that altered state of consciousness in which we take for granted that these things do exist and can exist and that these powers can work, as we do in dreams. If you think about dreams, you know, many times when we dream, for example, we may rise up off the ground and start flying in our dreams. But have you ever noticed that it doesn't surprise you? When you're in the dream world, you're not surprised by these bizarre things. Whereas, you know, in the physical world, you know, you'd be shocked if anything like that happened.
And on the other side, when you have those dream worlds where you're able to fly, as you become more conscious of the fact you're flying, the harder it is to get off the ground, or the harder it is to get higher. It seems like then we start to lock into our own paradigm of consciousness again, and that's what drags us down.
That's right. And the training for lucid dreaming is actually quite similar to the training of magicians and sorcerers. And so learning how to manipulate that dream world, that alternate realm, is in a very important stage in the development of what we call magic, because that's magic in action. You know, the only question is, to what degree can that be translated into the physical world?
Dr. Andrew Nichols, always a pleasure talking with you. Thank you for coming on and sharing some insight from a parapsychological viewpoint about magic and witchcraft. It's a pleasure talking to you, sir.
Thank you so much, Dave. It has been a pleasure, and I appreciate it.
And thank you all for listening. And do me a big favor. Over the next day and weeks, I want you to start focusing for yourself. Don't be convinced by what others have thought about you and what they say you are or limited you to. I want you to not be conceited. I want you to become convinced to your own abilities and open yourself to the possibilities that you are so much more than you give yourself credit for. And this isn't meant to be some tree huggery, metaphysical mumbo jumbo. This is something that I know is within all of us. I've seen the magic happen with Tim and I. I've seen the magic happen with my children. People do astounding things when they open up and believe and give credence to that belief. And I believe that that is something that can change your life and your paradigm starting today. We're all looking for that magic bullet when it's in fact been around us the whole time. It's in the concept of believing in yourself and not giving in to the words, feelings, and insecurities of others to dictate your self-worth. It's important. I know it sounds schmaltzy and hard to wrap your head around, but you know what? It's like the old saying goes, what if one apple a day does keep the doctor away? What if it is that simple? Just by giving yourself that belief, you can start to make the magic happen in your life. I believe magic exists all around us every day in every way. And if you are open to it and akin to it, you will start to have that magic take place in your life. Get rid of your got-tos, turn them into get-tos. Instead of focusing on the negativity, look at the positive side of what you've got coming in your life. And sometimes I know it's harder than others when you're in those dark moments, but that's when you have to dig the deepest. And that's when you have to let that light shine through and come back out of you. We care about you. We love you here on Beyond the Darkness. We'd like to have you with us for a good long time, and I'd like to see more of you start to soar. For Tim Dennis, I'm Dave Schrader. Special thanks to Dr. Andrew Nichols for joining us. We'll be back again tomorrow night as we take a look at Vanquishing Ghosts and Demons, a medium's harrowing tales of removing evil spirits. That takes place tomorrow on the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Beyond the Darkness.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.